rocket ship. Off we go on a trip. Heading for the moon at a rocket clip. We're gonna zoom, zoom, rocket. Zoom a little zoom, now we're almost free from the Earth's gravity. Zooming to the moon at terrific speed, because there is no friction. Soon we'll see if the moon is made out of green cheese. Ha 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 ha. Zoom, we're here at the moon. Let's see what the moon is like.
Hey there all, welcome to another edition of my science project. Welcome, in fact, to my first show of 2008. I'm thrilled to be here. Happy that you are still listening and tuning in, at least with one ear, if not with two. To celebrate the year in science, this week's show is dedicated to the best and most interesting science of 2007. I'll talk about our most recent extinction event. I'll tell you how rocket science can pay off big time. We'll ask the question and answer, are computers best left sleeping? Plus avalanche science and killer monkeys. Always good. Always good fun. Good times. Plus some science news, the year's best science books, and as always, a whole lot more. So the science news that I have for you today, two stories are actually from this month, so they're 2008. And two are, let's say, in keeping with our review of the best science of 2007, because they're stories that, well, one was from the end of December and one was from the fall. But before we get to those, the first of our January stories is one about something called rogue black holes. Astronomer Kelly Holly Bockelman and her research team have discovered something called rogue black holes, or errant black holes, each of which is 100 to 1,000 times the mass of our sun. And they discover these black holes by studying clumps of ancient stars known as globular clusters. These globular clusters are rough environments, and in them black holes are constantly sinking towards the center of the cluster, and occasionally meeting in violent mergers that tend to throw one or the other of these black holes out of the cluster at speeds that I can't contemplate, of about 9 million miles per hour. Holly Bockelman's computer simulations showed that scientists haven't spotted nearly as many black holes getting kicked out of globular clusters as they would have predicted. So from this information, she draws the conclusion that there must be, this is great news, extra black holes lurking around that are invisible to our measurement tools. We know there is evidence for huge, supermassive, as they're called, black holes sitting in the middle of galaxies. And there is also evidence for small black holes produced from giant stars, though I'm not sure what a very small black hole would look like. It's all intimidating to me. Nonetheless, Holly Bockelman's work modeled what is called an intermediate mass black hole. These are these rogue black holes that her team has reported, and no one seems to know where they are or quite exactly why they are the way they are. But again, our chances of being eaten up by a black hole are really, really slim, so I won't worry about it, and neither should you. A story reported also from Nature News is that air pollution causes sperm mutations in mice. This story has some Canadian content to it, because in fact, they used Canadian mice who were situated downwind of steel mills in Hamilton, Ontario. The mice were reared in these cages and kept in a shed that were downwind of two steel mills and a busy highway. And after analysis, these male mice showed a host of genetic changes compared to similarly housed control mice who were breathing filtered air. DNA in the sperm of the male mice in the polluted area contained 60% more mutations. They had more DNA strand breaks, which are really serious problems where the DNA actually breaks and then the code can't be read. this can lead to cancers and different types of nasty diseases. And the mutant mouse sperm had more bases that had been chemically modified via the addition of a methyl group. So, of course, DNA is made up of different base pairs. When a methyl group is added, this is called methylation, and it can control how the genes in the DNA encoded there are expressed. All told, these changes could, in theory, alter gene expression and function in the offspring of these male mice. Now, this work was published in the middle of January. It was published January 13th in Nature, but the original paper was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences USA. The lead author is Carol Yauch of Health Canada in Ottawa, and she and her colleagues did this study. The information that they've turned up can have really profound outcomes, not just obviously on males, but on the pregnancies, because the sperm are going towards making the baby mice. How the pollution caused the DNA damage is still a mystery. It could be that changes in the sperm of these mice were a more general response to what they call particulate pollution. For instance, metals bound to the particulates can favor the production of chemically reactive forms of oxygen, called reactive oxygen species, or ROSs. This is the latest scientific lingo for the things that we hear about in relation to antioxidants. So these are ROSs, are things that our bodies produce naturally every day as an outcome of chemical reactions. But in a normal balance, our body is able to mop up the ROSs and basically contain their damaging effects. Things like pollution can throw this balance out of whack. So that means that we could end up with various diseases, again, including the big C, cancer. Now, if it is this ROS business that's going on that's inducing these mutations in the mouse sperm, then it might have a general applicability to other sources of pollution and not just steel mills. So in some ways that bodes well for us, because we might have a sense of what's causing these reactions, but it also bodes poorly because it could mean that various kinds of pollution can do these nasty things. Now on to slightly devilish news. Published in late December on the BBC News, it turns out that Christians in the town of Reeves, located in the United State of Louisiana, have been unhappy since the early 1960s about their town being given the area code prefix 666, traditionally known as the biblical number of the beast. For about the next 3 months, households in Reeves will be able to change the first three digits of their phone numbers to the more innocuous 749. This comes on the heels of lobbying from two of Louisiana senators to change the number with the phone company, and also lobbying the State Public Service Commission. Mayor Walker of the town of Reeves said that he's already made the switch to the 749 prefix and expects approximately 80% of the town's 450 homeowners to do the same. There's no notice whether or not the 20% are worshiping active Satanists or what. But nonetheless, apparently 80% will make the change over. The reference to 666 is taken from translations of the biblical book of Revelation, which talks about the events leading to the end of the world. Revelation 13:18 states, "If anyone has insight, let him calculate the number of the beast, for it is man's number. His number is 666. Interestingly, in recent years, scholars at Oxford University said that they discovered a 3rd century papyrus from Oxyrhynchus, which gives the number of the beast as 616, and a manuscript fragment from the 11th century lists the number as 665, which might be a typo, suspiciously close to 666, but I didn't know that there was some debate on that one. A point of interest, the fear of the number 666 is known as the mouthful word, hexacosiohexacontahexaphobia. The last news story, which also is from late 2007, this was reported in the month of October, turns out wild monkeys killed a senior Indian government official in his home. We at My Science Project are big fans of monkeys, but we in no way, shape, or form can condone this violent monkey behavior. New Delhi Deputy Mayor S.S. Bajwa died after being pushed from his balcony during the attack by the gang of rhesus macaques. Last year, the Delhi High Court reprimanded city authorities for failing to stop the animals from terrifying residents and asked them to find a permanent solution to the monkey menace. Well, why is this? Turns out that part of the problem is that devout Hindus believe monkeys are manifestations of the monkey god Hanuman and feed them bananas and peanuts, hence encouraging these rhesus macaques to hang out in public. Over the years, city authorities have employed monkey catchers who, get this, use a larger and fiercer kind of monkey called a langur to scare or catch the macaques. However, the problem persists. This murder of S.S. Bajwa by a gang of rhesus macaques is a record, as it is the first time a high-profile dignitary has been killed by monkeys. And on that note, this is Monkey Knife Fight with Made in Carolina.
Stranger than fiction, more deadly than alive, able to freeze earthlings with a zombie stare, the aliens are here. The frontline 5th Column shock troops are already in position, in possession of a horde of terrestrial subway riders. Guiding their somnambulist host through a waking dream, celestial body snatchers melt into the rush hour crowds, elbow to elbow with the panic-stricken, guilt-ridden, unforgiven people of the Blue Planet. They came from beyond belief. They came to Necropolis. They are here.
Prepare. This officer, this man, can't ever be this way. It's all that we're here to say. See it all today. See it all today.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much.
We're a monkey knife fight.
You're listening to My Science Project on CITR 101.9 FM. I am your host, Julia. And this week's show is taking a look at the best science news stories of the last year. That would be 2007. I sourced Scientific American and Nature. They usually do a pretty good rundown of the year's best science. I was a little bit disappointed by this year's list. I thought last year's goings-on were a little bit more sexy. If I can say that about scientific content, which I feel that I'm qualified to do. But having said that, there certainly was stuff that went on that was quite impactful this year. Perhaps one of the most high-profile events that we have all heard of, I think, is the awarding of the Nobel Peace Prize to Vice President and once presidential candidate Al Gore, and the IPCC, or International Panel on Climate Change, did a rather good job of legitimizing the fact that climate change is a direct result of human activities rather than some kind of freakish natural phenomenon. And hot on the tails of that news, it turns out that Arctic ice is also shrinking to a record low. Last year, it covered just over 4 million square kilometers as measured in September 2007. The year's melt also opened up the long-coveted Northwest Passage shipping route, which connects the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, so I know there are some business people who are quite excited by that, I suppose, positive spin-off of climate change. Nature Medicine just earlier this month published a letter about the medical implications of climate change on human health. And it turns out that a growing body of evidence has suggested that climate change might influence the distribution of devastating illnesses such as malaria, which is a huge killer of people, particularly in Africa, as well as heat stroke. No surprise there, I guess. Researchers estimate that global warming could mean a 45 to 70% increase in the number of people exposed to dengue fever worldwide. That was reported first in The Lancet. Maria Neira, Director for Public Health and the Environment at the World Health Organization, noted that no more than a 1% centigrade increase in temperature could lead to an 8% increase in the incidence of diarrhea, which again kills a huge number of people every year, a large number of them children. These are actually stats that were published in recent years. They didn't come out in 2007, but it sort of helps to drive the message home that global warming is a little bit of a problem. On other news, a Libyan medical team was finally freed after 8 years in jail. Medical workers sentenced to death in Libya for deliberately infecting kids with HIV were freed by a consortium. The Palestinian-born doctor and 5 Bulgarian nurses were incarcerated after an outbreak of HIV in the Al-Fateh Hospital in Benghazi back in 1998, despite a lack of scientific evidence. The case met with international condemnation and outrage by scientists, and if you had picked up a Nature magazine in the last year, there were a flurry of letters and articles about this very case in that publication. The medical worker sentences were commuted to life imprisonment, and they were flown to Bulgaria, where they were pardoned on the airport tarmac in Sofia in July. That was some happy news. Here's some sad news. We had a major extinction event that happened just last year. The freshwater dolphin from the Yangtze River in China, called the Baiji, is functionally extinct because even if a scattered few of these dolphins still exist in the waters of the Yangtze River, There are not enough of them to reproduce and perpetuate the species. This is a particularly sad extinction event, if you can say that, if you can weigh them, because the Baiji has been on Earth for at least 20 million years. It's a terribly ancient species that had been very successful. These freshwater dolphins are characterized by a long tapering snout and crest-like remnant dorsal fin. Several thousand were reported in ancient times. This has dwindled to just a few hundred by the last decade. In 1999, only 13 of the animals were sighted, and the extinction of this group has been attributed to overfishing, construction of the Three Gorges Dam, and to other changes in the vicinity of the Yangtze River, where more than 10% of the human race makes its home. Even though there are laws set against fishing, for example, the use of indiscriminate electrical charges and so-called rolling hooks that snag fish, locals persisted with these techniques, and this was a huge contribution to why the dolphin went extinct. The loss of the Baiji dolphin marks the first extinction of a large animal since the disappearance of the Caribbean monk seal in the 1950s, though the UN estimates that three smaller animal or plant species go extinct every hour. Nice. Did Neanderthals talk? We don't really know, but researchers at the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig published an article last fall. They've managed to extract DNA from Neanderthal fossils. This Neanderthal DNA sequencing project has been very high profile and very exciting. And in sequencing this genome, they turned up a gene called FOXP2. The human version of the FOXP2, which is short for forkhead box P2, differs from that of the chimpanzee, which is our closest living relative, in two places along the genetic code, causing differences in two amino acids in the protein coded by the gene. Why is this important? Because chimpanzees don't talk. Certainly not the way the humans do. They vocalize, but they cannot speak as we do. And hence the idea is that these genetic differences in the FOXP2 gene may be one of the mechanisms by which we have managed to evolve the linguistic capabilities that we currently have. And since Neanderthals have this version of the FOXP2 gene, they too may have also spoken. FOXP2 was first tied to language back in 2001 when a mutation in this gene was shown to affect a modern human person's ability to speak. FOXP2 is not the only gene that's associated with the ability to speak. So these data need to be taken with a little bit of a grain of salt because language is a rather complex thing involving more than simply one gene. The FOXP2 gene has been around for a very long time in evolutionary terms. It's found in a similar form in other distantly related vertebrates, and it may be important not only for brain development and function, but also in other tissues. So there may be other reasons why Neanderthals also have our modern human version of this gene. The researchers also reported that this gene is ancient enough that it evolved before the split between Neanderthals and humans. In the DNA sequencing project using the Neanderthal fossil, the researchers have not found any evidence for interbreeding between modern humans and Neanderthals. Continuing on in the primate theme, late this year, November, primate stem cells were successfully cloned. Researchers reported that they generated the first confirmed embryonic stem cells from an adult primate, non-human primate in this case, suggesting that it may only be a matter of time and eggs before they perfect a similar technique or the same technique in us. A team from Oregon Health and Science University in Portland implanted the contents of individual skin cells from adult male rhesus macaques into each of 304 macaque egg cells that were stripped of their genetic material. In two cases, the hijacked eggs grew into early-stage embryos that yielded embryonic stem cell lines, indicating that the host successfully reprogrammed the skin cell DNA into an embryonic state. Now, after the huge scandal with a scientist named Hwang, who is Korean, you might remember in the last year or so, he fudged his stem cell data and reported completely fabricated results in his success for cloning stem cells in humans. Nature took an unprecedented step and actually got this study corroborated by independent sources before they published the paper. The trick with this particular primate study is that the team has yet to try to impregnate female monkeys with the embryos derived using this new method. Why are stem cells important? Well, the idea is to create stem cells that match an individual's immune system in order to repair damaged tissue, for example, spinal cord injuries or tissue damaged by disease such as diabetes, Parkinson's, and Alzheimer's. Stem cells are one way to basically perfectly match an individual and give them these new and healthy tissues. There was another breakthrough involving skin embryonic stem cells. This was actually using humans, so in some sense it's even more exciting. Work had been done in mouse, but they took skin cells from humans and did the same thing I just described. They basically took out the genetic information from an egg, they put in the human skin cell DNA, and they managed to basically hijack that egg cell and get it to start forming an embryo using the skin cell. What this does is it leapfrogs the need for any kind of human embryonic tissue whatsoever. It means that adults can donate their own skin cells to be generated into embryonic stem cells using basically a blank egg. The last news story for this particular segment is that rocket scientists actually can pay off pretty big time. This was published back in December in Nature. They reported that a formerly top secret document produced by controversial rocket scientist Wernher von Braun for his PhD dissertation sold for $33,000 US at an auction in New York. The thesis, which was only 166 pages, which I suppose is actually not that short for physics or math theses, but it was entitled Design, Theoretical, and Experimental Contributions to the Problem of the Liquid Fuel Rocket, was classified as top secret by the Nazi government, and although it was written back in 1934, the thesis was not published until 1960. After working on rockets for the Nazis during the Second World War, and the motives of von Braun are still debated, von Braun was spirited away to the United States, where he then worked on missiles in that country, later becoming the first director of NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama. Apparently, the thesis, which again sold for $33,000 US, sold for $3,000 more than its original estimate. So, there you go. Who says rocket science doesn't pay?
The historical conquests of Josh Ritter catches the Idaho musician in the midst of a radical transformation.
Josh manages to squeeze in a few admiring words about Joan of Arc, Calamity Jane, and Florence Nightingale, as well as ladies' underwear.
Don't miss the new musical trails that Josh Ritter is blazing at the Commodore Ballroom, Saturday, February 23rd.
Presented by Live Nation and with special guest M. Griner. Tickets available now at all Ticketmaster outlets or by phone 604-280-4444. I was looking for you, bright smile, dark eyes.
Well, there's one thing, Mama, I think you should know. It is not love that makes flowers grow, but a complex electron transfer process known as photosynthesis when chlorophyll reacts to the light of day. Since you're gone, the light has gone away. There's one more thing, Mama, I think that you'll find. It is not love that makes the stars shine, but a for the spontaneous combustion of superheated supercondensed gases in a process known as fusion that creates new elements when the time is right. Since you're gone, stars don't shine so bright. Oh, there's another thing, Mama. I think I should confide. It is not love. That'll turn the tide. But the net difference in the gravitational pull between the Earth and the Moon is it has acted out upon the waves. But since you're gone, I feel washed away. I could have been a mathematician, studied rockets for a living, would have worked out better in the end. But to get more specific, I break every law of physics to bring you back to me again. But there's one more thing I'll tell you if I can. It is not love that makes a nonstick frying pan, but a top-secret trademark conglomerated, most likely carcinogenic polyurethane compound spreading a micro-thin substance over a negatively charged layer of aluminum, copper, iron, lead, VHS, FYI, apple pie, FBI, and some other elements too. Since you're gone, I wish I'd stuck to you.
Hey there, we're back. We just heard Josh Ritter perform his song Stuck to You, also known as the Science Song. And that means that you're listening to My Science Project on CITR 101.9 FM. We're continuing on with our listing of the best science stories of 2007. And in the second part of this two-part segment, there are a couple of interesting items. One has to do with Parkinson's gene therapy. This was published back in the summer of 2007, and it involves injecting viruses into the human brain. An innocuous gene-bearing virus injected into the midbrains of 12 patients who suffered from Parkinson's disease improved the subject's motor function while causing no adverse effects. The study was published in The Lancet, and Parkinson's is a pretty impactful disease. It's estimated to affect, just in America alone, 500,000 people, so 500,000 folks. And it is a disorder that typically strikes people in their 60s. It's characterized by tremors, stiffness, loss of speech, and difficulty with motor function. I think a lot of us have had at least one grandparent who has suffered with Parkinson's in their lifetime. Neuroscientists have tracked the biological cause of Parkinson's to the loss of neurons or nerve cells in a midbrain region called the substantia nigra. And this midbrain area produces a neurotransmitter called dopamine, and this helps to maintain proper movement control. What happens when dopamine levels are low is that there's another region in the brain that overproduces something called glutamate. This basically overstimulates neurons that are downstream of this chemical, and it triggers a strong inhibitory response that results in disrupted movement. So it's not exactly a simple pathway, and it basically means that you don't have control of your physical movements. It's possible to reverse this effect using a primary inhibitory neurotransmitter called gamma-aminobutyric acid, or GABA. And this can make the neurons settle down and can restore normal motor function. What the team did was they injected a virus to transport a gene that codes for GABA, ultimately. The gene stimulates parts of the brain to produce this chemical GABA, leading to a control, or at least an increased level of control of motion. What's fascinating about this, aside from injecting a virus into the brain, which is cool enough in itself, is that even though the research team was very cautious about doing this, they were suspicious that there would be significant side effects, there were no incidents of infection, immune response, or toxicity associated with the viral injection into the brain, suggesting that this might actually be a safe, reliable, and effective way forward for treating Parkinson's patients. Another story involving a virus that was published in fall of 2007 revolves around viruses and cancer. Some cancers are caused by a virus. One of the most high-profile of these is cervical cancer. Scientists at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine of Yeshiva University in New York City say the key to conquering human cancers that are caused by a virus, and in the case of humans, it's the human papillomavirus that leads to cervical cancer, for example. Liver cancer is caused by Hep B and C viruses. The key, they say, is to find and destroy the viruses before they turn cancerous. The technique that they use to do this is called radioimmunotherapy, where they latch a radioisotope, which is an unstable element that releases radiation and in normal circumstances would be bad to handle, mounted onto an antibody, which is basically like a puzzle piece that will go and find a specific virus. So these antibodies go and they zero in on the target virus, and the radioisotopes that are attached to these antibodies destroy the nearby cancer cells without destroying the normal healthy tissue that's surrounding the tumor, which is quite amazing. Viral antigens, which are the things that the antibodies latch onto, are proteins that are made by virus-infected cells that can cause the cells to basically go crazy and multiply out of control, which is exactly what happens when cancer forms and you get a tumor. These researchers tested the theory on mice and found that there was a significant positive effect of doing this radioimmunotherapy. The findings were published in the Public Library of Science, or PLOS I, and they found that in some cases, not only did this therapy stop the growth of the tumor, but it could actually shrink the tumor in some cases in these mice. One of the senior co-authors, Ekaterina Datachova, is an expert in radioimmunotherapy. Last year, she and her colleagues showed that the therapy could also be used to help stop HIV by targeting one of several viral proteins on the surface of HIV-infected cells. It sounds like radioimmunotherapy is a very promising way forward. On another note, in the fall of 2007, there was a study published about the disappearance of honeybees in North America. And you may remember this. It was really a high-profile case because it was so weird and mysterious that all of a sudden honeybees were disappearing. And there were theories that included things such as parasite, varroa mites, to chemical pesticides, to even cell phone radiation and the towers were somehow disorienting the bees and resulting in them flying off and ultimately dying and nasty, horrible things like that. Now, this mysterious illness has really confounded U.S. beekeepers since 2006. And in 2007, it was published that this issue may stem from a bee virus. Here we go with viruses again. That apparently spread to the U.S. from Australia 3 years ago, so like around 2003. Researchers performed a sophisticated genetic comparison of healthy and diseased U.S. bee colonies, and through this found that there was something called Israeli Acute Paralysis Virus, or IAPV, an obscure but lethal bee bug, in almost all of the beekeeping colonies affected by what they called colony collapse disorder, or CCD, which is where all the bees just kind of up and left. And only one healthy colony that they looked at had this virus. They haven't proven that this virus is the cause, but there was a key line of evidence that suggests that it does play a major role. In fact, the group found that they could restore empty hives where the colonies had disappeared by restocking them with fresh bees, but only once they had irradiated the hive with gamma rays to destroy all viral DNA. The disorder, in a more holistic point of view, may also result from a combination of poor nutrition, pesticides, and other factors, including perhaps this viral infection, or probably this viral infection. If IAPV is the main trigger of colony collapse disorder, honeybees worldwide may be able to be bred with strains of bees that are resistant to the virus. It's really important to maintain healthy honeybee colonies because bees are estimated to provide pollination valued at $15 billion every year and are already worked to the limit. Half of the nearly 2.5 million hives in the U.S. alone are needed to pollinate almond crops. And lastly, it turns out that the first whole human genome was actually decoded last year. Two human beings had their full genome sequenced. These include James Watson, he who really shamed himself last year when he made very racist comments about the lower intelligence of people who had darker skin pigmentation and was forced to retire from his position at Cold Springs Harbor. And Craig Venter, he who was a part of the race to sequence the human genome. He founded a private company that had taken on the Wellcome Burroughs Trust in their public venture to do the sequencing. These sequences were the first in an anticipated wave of personal genome sequencing and are a crucial step towards personalized medicines tailored to the individual's genetic makeup. In James Watson's case, this might be a pill for foot and mouth disease. In November, Google backed a Californian biotech firm called 23andMe. They launched a $1,000 personal genome service. That same month, the Icelandic Decode Genetics company began to offer DNA testing for disease-linked genes for the same price. It looks like there won't be much of a slowdown on personal genome sequencing, at least for a little while. I came across two science stories that I thought were worth a note on the show, in addition to, you know, all the other science stories that I thought were worth a note on this show. One was published in Scientific American. They have a section called Fact or Fiction that they do on a regular basis. And this one tested a myth that was of particular interest to me because it's been something that I've wondered about and I've been involved in lighthearted debates about the issue. This is whether leaving your computer on will actually help it last longer. This story was a little bit dissatisfying because it basically says that how you end your computer session depends on how often you use your computer, your views on energy conservation, and what you've been told about how your decision will affect your computer's longevity. Basically, the bottom line is that your computer is more likely to be damaged by a virus that from being turned off and on too much. So the question here is, do you leave your computer on or put it on standby, hence extending its life, or do you turn it off to save more energy and possibly shorten the life of your machine? If you want your computer to consume as little energy as possible, of course you shut it down. If you want it to consume absolutely no energy, unplug it. Your PC typically goes into three states. It can be in on, sleep, or off, each of which draws some level of electric current. If you have a laptop, you're going to take up a lot less energy than if you have a desktop. A desktop uses more energy because its power supplies are less efficient, and they require a separate and often larger power-hungry monitor. And in fact, your monitor is, I think, one of the largest energy-guzzling parts of your entire machine, so if you do nothing else, if you own a desktop, at least turn the monitor off before you walk away. Further, your energy consumption depends on the kind of work you're doing. Complex calculations that require intensive processing eat up more power, whereas if you're just doing some web browsing or some word processing, your machine is consuming far less electricity. Basically, it's up to you. If you have been leaving your computer on because you think it's really going to extend its lifetime, it probably won't make that much of a difference in the grand scheme of things, particularly since, as this study says, you're more likely to get whacked by a virus. Certainly, if you can put it into standby mode, that's a good thing. I have the perhaps bad habit of opening up a million gajillion tabs in Firefox and then hating to shut it all down. I've ended up just deciding to crash Firefox and turn my computer off at the end of the day and then restore the whole thing. But I hear that Firefox, which is an open source browser, one of the latest versions has a function where you can actually store the history of your last session and then shut the program down normally and then recall it when you fire it up again. Another story from Scientific American that was published at the end of last month in December, was about toxins in the home, particularly something called bisphenol A. And this is a component of the light plastics used in baby bottles, which is kind of creepy, and many other consumer products. And in the past several years, scientists have reported that low levels of bisphenol A can disrupt cell division, leading to spontaneous miscarriages and even birth defects such as Down syndrome. Back in early 2007, a team led by Patricia Hunt of Washington State University found that small amounts of bisphenol A interfered in mice embryos with the growth of egg cells in the developing mice embryos. As many as 40% of these eggs from the fetuses exposed to bisphenol A had an abnormal number of chromosomes. Of course, this is the cause of something like Down syndrome. What's even creepier about this is that the chemical's effects can run through three generations. So this mutation caused by bisphenol A, apparently, in these mouse embryos are translated through three lines of mice. The National Toxicology Program, which is part of the National Institutes of Health in the U.S., is currently reviewing the safety of bisphenol A. In the meantime, should you be pregnant, some physicians advise pregnant women to avoid drinking water from plastic bottles. In fact, there are lots of good reasons to not drink water from plastic bottles, particularly if the water's been sitting in there for a long time, or if the bottle's really scuffed up and damaged, because even artificial estrogens are in a lot of our plastics and can leak and can cause problems in women and men. But basically, you might want to resort to having a metal or ceramic travel mug. There was another interesting note in this article. I thought it was worth mentioning. I don't know how it goes in Canada, and maybe it just depends on your province or your city, but unused pharmaceuticals are a particularly serious threat to us because we often flush them down the toilet when we're done with them, or they've expired. We're not sure how else to safely dispose of them. But what this does is it sends these chemicals into our rivers and lakes. And, for example, discarded birth control pills can trigger reproductive problems in fish, and surplus antibiotics can enhance the spread of bacteria that are resistant to drugs. And that costs millions of lives and dollars a year just in bacterial resistance. Causes lots of health problems for humans. So the next best option, if you don't have a program at your pharmacy, and I would suggest taking your stuff back to any old pharmacy and asking them to dispose of it for you, but if you're unable to do that or your pharmacy won't accept your expired or now not necessary drugs, the next best thing apparently is to crush and dilute the medicines, perhaps with baby powder, and seal them in plastic bags and then dump them in the trash. So don't put them into a liquid waste system. Don't put them in the water supply. Stick them in solid waste. This is Science is Golden by the Greats. If you'd like to get in touch with us here at My Science Project, that would be me or my lovely co-host, Anne. You can shoot us an email at myscienceprojectradio@yahoo.ca. Any suggestions, critiques, unfettered, adoring praise, all that stuff, totally welcome to send it. myscienceprojectradio@yahoo.ca. Since this show is a review of the best science of 2007, I thought it would be nice to actually do a little bit of review of some of the best science books of the last year as well. And this is a list that I found online, posted by a fellow named John Dupuy, who happens to be the head of the Stacey Science and Engineering Library at York University. And he has a blog called Confessions of a Science Librarian. It's just filled with really interesting stuff, among which are, as you might expect from a librarian, his compilation of some of the top-rated science books from 2007. One of the sources for this list is the Toronto Star, and this was compiled by Peter Calamai, who's a science reporter for the Star. Among his lists are one book that I featured on a show not too long ago by Alex Boyce, and this book is called Elephants on Acid and Other Bizarre Experiments. I did this around Halloween and talked about some rather creepy, strange stuff that went on. So if you want something that will kind of shock and awe you, Elephants on Acid, I think, would be a good book. Another science book along the lines of disease is Deadly Companions, How Microbes Shaped Our History by Dorothy Crawford. Two Canadian books that have come out in the last year are Canada Rocks, The Geologic Journey by Nick Iles and Andrew Mjall, and another book called Silence of the Songbirds, How We Are Losing the World's Songbirds and What We Can Do to Save Them. This was written by a York University prof named Bridget Stitchbury. Lastly on the Toronto Star's list is How to Build a Robot Army, Tips on Defending Planet Earth Against Alien Invaders, Ninjas, and Zombies by Daniel H. Wilson. Sounds like very intense and serious reading. Next up on the list is one from the Globe and Mail. This book is called The World Without Us by Alan Wiseman. Scientific American, I believe, featured this concept, basically what would planet Earth look like without human beings on it. Another book that seemed to get well reviewed is called The Grid, A Journey Through the Heart of Our Electrified World by Phil Hsu. This was from Science Friday, actually, National Public Radio's science show. They have a very long list. I've just picked a few. So there was The Grid. The next one is The Invisible Cure, Africa, the West, and the Fight Against AIDS, authored by Helen Epstein. Another book that gets a lot of mentions on many lists, either as a really good science book or an honorable mention, is a book called Musicophilia, Tales of Music and the Brain by Oliver Sacks. And I think this might have been mentioned by Anne on a previous show. And I remember CBC doing a segment, actually, I think it was Jean Gameschi, talked with the author, because it's all about how the brain processes music and what it means to us and how physiologically it affects our heads. That sounds pretty interesting. If you don't have a pen handy or a paper, or you're in the car and you don't want to be crazy and unsafe by scribbling all these book titles down, our show is, of course, podcast on CITR.ca, so you can check it out there at your leisure. Or if you want to get in touch again, myscienceprojectradio@yahoo.ca will do the trick. There was a news release put through the University of Calgary all about snow. And it's really snowed here the last couple of days. So this is apropos, particularly since there is also an avalanche awareness day that was recently held between January 11th and 13th. in over 30 communities across Canada. Basically, this press release was letting us know that the Schulich School of Engineering here at the U of C has a group of researchers who have pioneered a new and promising test to help predict avalanches. This test is called the Propagation Saw Test, or PST, which will help snow scientists and avalanche experts better assess the spreading tendency of cracks in snowpack layers, which often lead to avalanches. The head of this team is Dr. Bruce Jameson, and he's co-edited and co-wrote a whole bunch of books about backcountry avalanche safety, some of which have been used for student manuals for the Canadian Avalanche Association's recreational avalanche courses. And the Canadian Avalanche Centre, or CAC, is the primary group that ran Avalanche Awareness Days just earlier this month. It's a national event. If you're interested in Avalanche Awareness Days, it basically is composed of daytime activities that include hands-on demonstrations of safety gear, such as avalanche beacons, probes, and shovels, and it includes tips on how to use public avalanche bulletins. Again, this is timely information because we still have a few months left on ski and snowboarding season, and avalanches, as we're aware, especially out here around the Rockies, can be incredibly dangerous and have certainly taken lives in recent years. If you're interested in finding out more about avalanche safety, Avalanche Awareness Days, or the Canadian Avalanche Center, you can visit www.avalanche.ca. That's it, kids, for another edition of my science project. Anne is up again in 2 weeks' time. And straight up now is Darren with Stereoscopic Readout. Have an excellent weekend. See you in about a month.